quite as much time for entertainment as teenagers now do.
Well, no, we didn't, but we had time to play. We had time to play. And one of the things that was really a major portion of our activities was going to church. You know, we'd go to church on Sunday. Well, they didn't have church at Sunday school. The preacher would come, you know, once a month. But that was an association that was important, very important when we were growing up as children. You know.
Okay, you had told me you were in World War II. When did you go into World War II?
Well, you know, the Great Depression triggered a lot of things. It caused a lot of things to change. And, of course, you know, I could preach a sermon about all the different things and faults of people and all that. But one of the things was the failure of the United Nations. The United States, of course, didn't support it. Woodrow Wilson wanted people to support it. I think they should have. And I think that would have avoided World War II. But the Depression came, and it struck here. It struck in France. And France didn't hurt too much. You know. They fared really good. But it struck Germany, and it really hurt them bad. And then not only did they have depression, but I don't know when the inflation hit. I don't know if it was before the depression or after. It was somewhere, I think, along in the 20s. And that really upset the economy in Germany. And people were disturbed, you know. And that allowed Hitler to take over by him preaching that he was going to make Germany a great country, and they're going to be great again. And although he started out as a socialist, which is sort of left-wing, then he wound up on the far right wing with a group, you know, that wanted to establish a dictatorship. And after he was in prison, you know, after he tried some sort of little revolutionary thing over there and somewhere in Germany, losing in Augsburg. Munich, I'm sorry. He got put in jail. And while he's in jail, he wrote a book called Mein Kampf. And it means my battle. And he was describing how he wanted to reestablish Germany as a major power that would control everything, control the whole world. And then he got people to back him, you see, and then they finally took over. First, they went out campaigning, you know, and they got their people elected. They didn't get a majority in the German legislature, Bundestag, I guess they called it, whatever it was. But anyway, their legislature. but they got, I guess it was in 1930, somewhere along in the early 30s, 33 maybe. They got enough elected that they were they had the most votes in the Congress for their legislative group. They weren't the majority, but they got the most votes. Well, they got these other parties to go along with them until they gained control and threw the president out and put Hitler in as the commander. Your Führer, the leader. So they did away with all the civilian laws and everything, you know, and made him, not civilian laws necessarily, but I mean, they made it so that nobody had any control but him, but they did it little by little, just one little degree at a time, and he finally got complete control. And then he started rearming Germany, which was against the United Nations and the treaty, you know, that had been signed. But he did it, and nobody stopped him. And from that, he went on and on. He was, you know, going to take over the world, make everybody a Nazi. And of course, England and France tried to stop him. And he first jumped on Poland, and then England and France tried to stop him. Then he conquered not only Poland, but France. And then Russia was supposed to be his friend, and then he jumped on them. And then finally, you know, we got into it by Japan attacking Pearl Harbor, because Japan and Germany and Italy were allies. Well, that was a terrible thing, because we knew that those armies of Hitler and Japan were really strong, and that we would have a hard time fighting them. See, Japan had been fighting China for probably 15, 20 years, and they had the whole time. They wanted to take over some more of China. They just knew and just take it over, you know. And they just took over just whatever they wanted to, you know. And when they attacked Pearl Harbor, of course, they took over a lot of our islands in the Pacific and everything. It was a scary time. It was really scary, because we didn't know, you know, if there was a chance for us to win or not. And in fact, we lost the war for the first year. But, you know, we finally got the tide turned, and we finally won. It was a hard time, because, you know, they had to ration things like sugar and coffee. They rationed tires and gasoline. They didn't make any cars during that time. They were making tanks and guns and things like that, you know. And the people that were civilians, they sort of had a hard time. Of course, they got by. Plenty of work for everybody. But they didn't have enough goods to sell, you know, so they had to ration things out so people wouldn't buy up everything.
Even though the war didn't actually happen in Alabama or anything, how did it affect the people? I mean, I know people were having to go off the war from here. What kind of did it affect?
Well, they had to sacrifice so much, you know. Because, like, for example, the shoes wear out. Well, you want to go to the store and buy a pair of shoes. Well, you can't buy a pair of shoes because you don't have a ration stamp. Or, you know, you're gonna have your family in for Sunday dinner, and you want to have some cake or something, maybe some sweets and things, and you need to, you know, make a cake. But you're out of sugar. You can't go buy sugar because you don't have another sugar stamp. See? You don't have these ration stamps. So it was hard on a lot of people because of the scarcity of goods and the rationing that they had to do. And then it was very hard on people that, you know, they sent off their sons and brothers to war, and then they get these telegrams delivered to their door. You know, they get the telegram. The telegram would say, "We regret to inform you that your son is killed in action in the situation." And a lot of people got those. A lot of people. But a lot of times they would send a telegram and say, "Your son is missing in action." And, you know, either they would turn up either later dead, or sometimes they'd turn up, they'd find him, you know, alive. But so many of them, you know, they never found. I went back 2 years ago to Normandy, where I went in on the beach. I drove the car through there. I went to the American Cemetery near, just north of St. Louis. I can't remember the name of the little town. Colville, I believe. In the French, they say Colville. But it was a huge cemetery, very pretty, very, very pretty. They got a wall there. They got all these crosses out there where the soldiers are buried, and some of them, you know, they have known only but to God. You know, they didn't know who he was. He just buried there. And then they got this wall. It's got all these names along the wall there, just a huge wall of soldiers that they never found their bodies. You know, they're missing. Still not found. But they got their names there. And a lot of those balls come out here. some friends of mine. I was in school.
Okay, to conclude, I would like to know a little bit about what you've done since then, about your teaching. I know you taught, it was a council, and I know you taught at Etowah, but were you always there?
I didn't start teaching until I was in my 30s. See, I worked in the foundry until I was close to 30, I guess. Then I did two or three other jobs. And then I finally got into education. My first experience in education was at Ducks Plains, in the valley up there, Big Valley. I taught math and science, and coached a little basketball team. And then I quit that and went back into industry and took a job in Birmingham as a founder supervisor. I was trying to phone them. And then that job sort of played out, and I came back up to the edge and took a job with General Time as a supervisor there, making timers for clocks and things. Of course, downstairs we were making timers for bombs and shells. And then that job sort of played out, and I messed around. I finally decided, well, I'd get back in education because I was getting close to 40 years old, and I knew I'd have a hard time ever getting another job. So it was, I went to work at Carlisle Elementary School, teaching math and science, and I think it's called a little music class. And I taught there about 2 or 3 years of this. And then from there, I went to Etowah County Vocational School, teaching business, accounting and business machines. Of course, don't ask me to teach business machines now, because I don't know these computers. I couldn't do it. But then from there, I went over to Henson as a counselor, and I stayed with the Tala system. Of course, they moved Henson up to the main part of the Tala there, where Etowah High School was, and called it Etowah Middle School. But I stayed with them for about 20-something years as a counselor.
Okay, while you've lived in the Tala, have you seen a lot of changes? Did you live in a Tala most of your life, some parts of it?
Well, since World War II, I've lived here at this house. I've lived here almost 50 years now. But prior to World War II, I've always lived in the down around Curtis Street. In the ridges down there up in Miller's Hollow and back down in the Flatwoods around Curtis and there. But, there's been a lot of changes. The town itself hasn't changed much here, the original town, but it's changed some. But one of the major changes about Etowah is that the city limits used to go just to the top of Sowers Hill out here, this side of where Etowah High School used to be. And then they extended it on down, and then they finally took in all of Curtiston down there. So, when I lived at Curtiston, there was all these pastures, for dairy farms and farms. Well, it's all houses down through there now, and it's all built up. It's so much different. I have to get way back up there in Miller's Hollow for it to look like it did when I was a boy.
Okay, well, I'd like to thank you for letting me interview you. And thank you for your time.